Joining me in the studio is Andrew Charles, the 78th Chancellor of the Philadelphia Bar Association. Welcome to Cuisine. It's good to have you here. I want to talk a little bit about where you've come from before we get into where you're heading. One of the things that fascinated me about reading about you and about your history was your fascination with the film Inherit the Wind. And I was hoping that we can elaborate a little bit about how that affected you, not only personally, but also as a career.
Well, you know, Inherit the Wind is a great reconstruction of the trial of the century.
Mm-hmm.
I think it ranks ahead of the O.J. trial as in importance, and it particularly should because it put onto a national and a world stage the entire issue of progress and technology versus the efforts of people to keep learning and education from triumphing and mm-hmm. from having an influence. And it was also great courtroom theatrics. It was actual real courtroom theatrics in the sense that there's very little of a difference between what's written in the trial transcript and the way Frederick March and Spencer Tracy battled it out. But I think I learned from that movie that a courtroom can be dramatic and a courtroom can be a great stage to argue great issues. Rules apply to how you argue, and there's a hope that the truth will out.
I've been in court cases where I've seen both sides really, you think these people hate each other, but when the gavel falls and people enter the room, these people work with each other. They're colleagues. And has that been something challenging for you to have to keep that balance between your professional face and your personal face when it comes to dealing with your colleagues?
Well, you know, there are two kinds of lawyers, who do transactions and business and lawyers who fight and do litigation. I'm one of those people who fights, and frankly, it's a weakness, but I don't function well in a completely cooperative environment. At the same time, the law and litigation is about solving problems in a civil way, about solving problems in a way where people don't gouge each other's eyes out and break each other's arms, but rather go into a room, have a neutral third party decide what's the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, lawyers work together while they're fighting with each other. And that's one of the pleasures of this leadership of the Bar Association is to get to know all these lawyers and to improve the level of collegiality, which makes problem solving easier. In the end, that level of collegiality is better for the clients. It's better for the people whose fights are being fought because it's less expensive and it results in people wasting less time and money on sideshows and getting to the real point.
It's been almost 15 years since the time when you became the first openly gay member of the Philadelphia Human Rights Commission. And I guess what fascinates me is that people take things for granted these days. But that was an interesting time back in 1990, joining the Human Relations Commission. And I'm wondering what that was like for you getting involved with on a local level for human relations and how that helped your own personal career getting involved with that commission.
Well, it was interesting how much support I had from the firm, for one thing. It was also interesting to go to the Human Relations Commission and to be the first person advocating systematically in that forum on issues related to gay rights.
Mm.
I think the commission was receptive, but I think that there were always new issues, and they seemed strange to people at that time. In fact, we had a gay marriage and domestic partnership case that had been hanging around for 10 years when I got there.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember feeling that I didn't want to push it because if we brought it to a vote, it might not win.
Right.
We're past that, at least on a local level, so that's good.
That obviously segues right into questions on a national level and getting your personal opinion about things like that's happened over the past year with the proposed constitutional amendments, the issues of marriage in both Massachusetts and, of course, the recent Supreme Court decisions. What's your take on that, and what's your personal viewpoint about what the road ahead might be happening?
Well, Robert, I think that you know, as Chancellor of the Bar Association, I'm only allowed to mm-hmm. have an opinion that the Bar Association has taken. Now, we have been very much against the constitutional amendment that would limit the state's opportunities to decide who gets married. And the states have managed marriage and should be able to. My personal opinions, one, you'd have to ask my husband, really, how I feel about gay marriage. But if we did get into them, obviously, I have my relationship, which we call a marriage, mm-hmm. which is not an official legally sanctioned marriage. And the Bar Association in Philadelphia has really been on the cutting edge of teaching people about the law, of relationships that are not marriage. We have a committee on the legal rights of unmarried cohabitants, which is trying to sort of help lawyers systematize how they deal with the fact that people in New Jersey might have a civil union, and people in Vermont have something else, and people in Pennsylvania have common law marriages, how you harmonize that when people move from state to state, and how you can advance people's rights short of marriage since we don't have it.
Do you find that the fact that each state is sort of going about it on their own way, will that become confusing for states to handle other commitments?
Well, it's going to be an issue, though we've had 200 and some odd years of different laws relating to marriage in different states anyway. Mm-hmm. There are states where the law allows you to marry when you're under 18, and states that don't. There are states that allow cousins to marry and states that don't. So we've had a history of being able to work through what happens when people move from state to state, and a history of having states recognize the acts of other states, and it hasn't been all that confusing. So when we have somebody from Massachusetts who's married, the law of the United States would have them stay married when they move to another state. And the Constitution probably requires that. We've got a lot of litigation to work through on things like that. It'll be interesting.
You had mentioned earlier, and I want to touch on it again, the Association's Committee on Legal Rights for Gay Men and Lesbians. And besides the marriage issue, what other issues was that committee tackling?
Well, that committee was formed in 1996 or 7. I was the first co-chair. We dealt with a number of things that were internal to the profession. We got the 25 largest firms in Philadelphia all to publicly state that they would not discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. We were instrumental in getting the Philadelphia Bar Association through its insurance programs to make it possible for every person who works for a law firm or a legal employer to have domestic partners benefits, so that this whole profession, including its paralegals and its secretaries and administrators, could all get domestic partners benefits. We've lobbied through the Bar Association, passed resolutions about the right to marry, about the right to form domestic partners. So we've been instrumental, along with other committees, in trying to modernize family law and non-discrimination law.
The Bar Association here in Philadelphia is known as a progressive association, and it's very cutting edge in many ways. But I'm wanting to know if you've experienced any homophobia towards the fact that the first openly gay chancellor is going to now preside. Have you heard anything or felt anything?
Not a bit of it, Robert. I would say that there have been occasions where I've heard people have said, oh, we have a gay lawyer, that's a new thing, or a gay leader, and that's a new thing. People in the profession and elsewhere are still becoming aware of all the gays and lesbians and transgendered people who are around them. And so I guess by being a leader, I'm sort of coming out for what's in the profession, and it has surprised some people, though not all. But certainly I have not encountered anybody who's resisted my becoming part of the leadership.
One of the things I wanted to talk about a little bit was the history of the first case in Pennsylvania that you were involved with regarding HIV discrimination. What was that case about, and how did it come out?
Well, this case was brought by a woman who had 10 children. She moved here from North Carolina to Philadelphia during World War II, spent her years here cleaning hospital rooms and cleaning people's houses, and raised 10 children. Her husband died on the day that her 10th son was born.
Wow.
And it was this, and she put 7 of them into college and all of them through high school after her husband died. This 10th son came down with AIDS, and she went to the funeral director who had done the funeral for her husband. And they asked the funeral director if he could do a funeral just like her husband's, and he said, I can, except that because your son has AIDS, it has to be a closed casket. That's the law. It wasn't the law, but she believed him. And he died some weeks later, and they did a funeral with a closed casket. The preacher preached over the closed casket, and the choir sang over the closed casket. And then there was a announcement that the pallbearers would go to one room and that they would meet the casket outside. So Mom asked the funeral director why the pallbearers weren't taking the casket out, and he said, "Oh, didn't we tell you? We couldn't bring your son in here. That's an empty casket, and the matching casket with your son in it is outside." So she wasn't all that happy.
So the whole ceremony happened without her son.
The ceremony happened without her son, and the closed casket was an empty casket. The jury found that the mother suffered emotional distress that was compensable in the amount of $75,000, and that the funeral director should pay punitive damages in the amount of about $125,000. The judge had predicted that the mother's emotional distress couldn't really be separated from her grief over her son's loss, but we were able to explain that if a funeral is ruined, it can make somebody even more aggrieved than normal, and they were outraged by the behavior. The behavior was basically lying, and so the jury returned a verdict of punitive damages of even more.
I know, obviously, you are looking forward to your term as chancellor in 2005, and I wanted to talk a little bit about some of your priorities. Reaching out to immigrant and non-English-speaking communities is a big priority for you. Do you want to elaborate a little bit about that?
Yeah, Philadelphia is like a lot of American cities, in fact, like almost all of them. Its growth has come not from high birth rates or from internal migration from other parts of the country, but from getting the best, the brightest, and the most ambitious people from beyond our 50 states. And there is a lot that we as a legal community can do to promote people coming and to make them full citizens and participants in our civic life and our economy. So we're going to have a task force that the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania asked us to have on how to make interpreters more effective and more available in the courts. We are going to teach what we call People's Law School, which is a school for non-lawyers about everyday legal problems. We're going to teach People's Law School in Russian. We're going to teach People's Law School in Spanish. Our legal referral service for people who are otherwise not connected to lawyers will be available in Spanish, thanks to us and the Hispanic Bar Association. We have forms about how to use municipal court for landlord-tenant issues available in Spanish and Vietnamese, or they will be available shortly. We have efforts to make it more possible for foreign lawyers to practice in Pennsylvania so that we can increase our international contacts. So all of these ways will enable immigrants to integrate into the economy and into every other part of our city, so that this is a good place for people to live and a good place for them to have opportunity for access to justice.
It sounds like a very heavy and full plate.
It's a lot to do, and one of the blessings of being chancellor is having the time that my firm gives me. They've basically given me the year off from practicing law, and the support of 13,000 lawyers who want us to do our part to make this city a better place.
When you flash back to your first couple of years practicing law and you look back at the early years of your tenure there, is it fascinating now to see yourself stepping in as chancellor? Do you have that moment where you just have to sort of pinch yourself and realize you've...
I do. I don't know how to say it, but 13,000 lawyers are looking at me and trying to make sure I do a good job. And it's just such an honor to be the leader of an association that's this well-functioning and has got this many people and this much ability to influence things for good.
And not to mention so much history.
Yes, we are the oldest bar association in America.
I wish you the best of luck. We hope we have you swing by every so often and fill us in on the things you guys are working on. I appreciate it.
I would look forward to it, Robert. Thanks. You.